Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wiss.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wiss, number 92. Sorry we missed you last go around. Was that 2 weeks ago? Yeah. And we almost had Tom Smith. We almost had an additional European. We have to have a quota of at least one European, and we've got that today in Thomas Kurnack. Where are you at, Thomas?
Hello, everyone. I am in Slovakia, the center, the actual geographical center of Europe, so you can't get more European than that.
And he's complete with his bag of chips. He just found out Slovakians now have chips, so he's very excited about that.
Oh, yeah.
New addition. You're getting all kinds of new Western stuff.
Yeah. I mean, chips and chocolate milk and stuff.
Soap and deodorant. You guys have that, right? Yeah.
All the good stuff is making its base in here now.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
So let's get the ugly stuff out of the way. And by ugly, I mean David Atias with Pennytone, who is our sponsor this month. You like that one, huh? So go to pennytone.com. Right now what he's doing is first month bill of a customer. So he is a VoIP-hosted provider. You send your business customers over there. They sign up with him. He ships them a bunch of phones, gets them hooked up. Soon as they pay their first bill, he basically sends it over to you in cash. Although, I don't know, maybe he'll send it to you in pennies. Or PayPal, I'm not sure. Probably whatever preferred method you have, he will get it to you over in that way. So jump over there, say hi to Dave, pennytone.com. New patrons. We have a new patron, and he's actually pretty active so far, Simon Green. And what is a patron? Go to patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You sign up there, and you get access to our patron-only Slack, where you get to hear Thomas rant about stuff pretty consistently. I would say there's a rant a week, maybe, something like that.
Got to keep the rant quota up as well.
We're all about our quotas. I think this one was, what was it? Something about certificates with GDPR in the United States. You can't, it's like tough or something like that. What was that? You're trying to sign your...
Do you really want the first topic to be immediately a rant?
See, I told you, rants. We are rant rich, I guess you could say. We have plenty of them. Now, I want you to build up to a fever pitch.
I'll do it.
You got to build up to it. We can't. That's what the people are here to see. You can't just, you know, give them the cow or rather the milk for free. They won't buy the cow, that kind of thing, you know. All right.
So we promise a rant somewhere along this guy.
Every time you're in here, we always promise a rant. They hear that accent and they're like, oh, I feel a rant coming.
So I have pretty much become the old rant guy at this point. Is that it?
I think you were always the all rant.
I'm not sure that's the legacy I want to leave behind.
You're not the hero deserve. You're the hero we need. That's what it is.
All right.
Great responsibility. Great power comes great responsibility. All right. So, first on the list, it's something personally for me. I'm looking for a reasonably priced OTDR. It was weird. Well, while I was trying to be on vacation, you're never truly on vacation in IT, right? So I
Maybe tell us what an OTDR is.
Oh, yeah. Well, I get a phone call of, we have this connectivity that goes down some dark fiber of ours, right? Dark being mean, it's ours. Nobody else is on there. And it went down, and I was like, well, why don't you switch to the backup pair? And they said, we have a backup pair there? And I was like, we sure do. As of like 10 months ago, I had them move a backup pair over there. Like, oh, okay, we'll do that. So they switched to the backup pair. Everything was great. But it turns out we're going to a university on this trunk, and they were using some of those strands, and they also went down. They're in like a change freeze, so they didn't really do any more than switch pairs, and it came up. So that's sort of where I'm at right now. The idea being something went wrong with that fiber somewhere. They actually were able to throw an OTDR on a single strand. An OTDR is optical time domain reflectometer, I think. In essence, this is my layperson's understanding of how it works. They fire a laser down the glass. They look for the reflections to come back, and they time it, right? So there's a, I guess a it's probably not a simple calculation, but light will travel through glass at a certain rate, and so they can, when they send out a pulse, they can time how long it takes to come back. And an OTDR, usually the cheaper ones anyway, or the older ones, I should say, create kind of a line graph. And that line graph can show you where there's a connector, because it'll look like an initial spike and then kind of a drop in signal. And then you can see splices where it's just a small drop in signal, right? There's no reflection kind of jumping up. And then you can see when there's like a break in the line where it just goes to nothing. So they threw an OTDR on one side and said the break was roughly in this area, maybe. I don't exactly know what the fiber looks like on there. From their side, because whenever it reaches the university, that's basically their sovereign territory. They own everything that goes over there, so it's not really our fiber anymore at that point. So I have to make my best estimate. So I had some of my guys go out there and walk the path. The only thing they saw, all this stuff's underground, they didn't see any disturbance in the dirt, but they did see a tree that was split in two in that easement because it had gotten hit by lightning. And we had a really bad electrical storm right about the same time it hit, right? So electrical storm, at first I was thinking rain, but there's no problems in any of our splice faults, anything like that. The only thing we could find was this tree, and so I'm assuming it got hit, you know, the lightning dissipated into the ground and maybe caught the edge of the fiber, maybe, something like that. I mean, it seems plausible, right? It was roughly where the OTDR said it theoretically could be, so I'm looking, I need to get an OTDR on my side of the fiber, on my strands that are toast, and kind of start doing some testing to see, because I know where my path is very well, and so I can a little bit more accurately kind of figure out where that is. If it is that tree, I guess we'll have to have a crew come out. Oh God, it's near a railway, so that's an easement. There's tons of fiber in there. It's gonna be a nightmare. I would almost rather just say, hey, those three strands of fiber that were affected are effectively dead, and we'll just write them off rather than try and mess with this stuff. Because, you know, the instant I get a crew out there and they start digging, it's going to cause problems. You know, it's going to happen. But a reasonably priced OTDR. So looking around on Amazon, AliExpress, all that stuff, it looks like you can get one, a very inexpensive one, anywhere from $800 to $1,200. But I don't. They all look the same. I don't really know which one's better than the others. Now, I have seen some really nice ones that instead of just giving you a line graph, they actually give you like blocks with information. So they make it really easy for a dummy like me who's, you know, not very familiar with what he's looking at there to kind of very simply understand what's going on. But some of those were like in the $10,000 range. And to be honest with you, we don't have much call for an OTDR. Maybe once every 2 years do we actually need. So it's like, it's kind of this weird, how do you justify the cost versus how often we need it, and maybe we should just call a guy out. But I was thinking, for the price of calling a team out to come and check all that stuff out with a really nice OTDR, we could probably afford an expensive one. So I'm trying to just get some industry opinions on that stuff. Do you guys, yeah, you don't do a lot of fiber work, do you, Thomas?
Not me personally. All of the fiber is handled by different people, so I know very little about fiber.
Yeah, I know just enough to be dangerous. But when you start looking for OTDRs, there's like a million different ones out there from a bunch of different vendors. I don't know what's any better than anything else. I just need somebody to give me their tried and true experience out there doing that stuff. That's a really unfortunate series of events. A tree getting hit takes my fiber out underground. Never heard of it, but I assume that probably can happen and has happened. So that's what I'm going to operate under.
We once had a lightning strike hit a church tower, and we had quite a bit of equipment about, oh, I would say maybe it was even like 150 meters away, which let me convert that to the freedom units. So that would be like 500 feet away from the church tower that got hit by lightning, and basically we had some like we had some outdoor cat between buildings, and we had you know, just normal Ethernet around buildings, and actually so the outdoor cable got literally the pairs got fused. And wow. So the outdoor cable had to be completely torn down and changed. And then inside of the buildings, phones went dead because of induction on the phone lines from the line ping. So we had to change a bunch of phones. And this was a combination of analog and SIP phones. And like there were dead switches. There were like this was, you know, 500 feet, so not a direct lighting, and then still the induction was so strong that it inducted enough current to either melt the pairs or induct enough current on the actual Ethernet ports to take down devices. So lighting can do some ridiculous stuff.
Yeah, I've seen some really crazy looking fulgurites before, you know, like when lightning strikes and it goes down into the like sandy soil and it solidifies it, you know, turns it into glass. You call those fulgurites. Those things are pretty hairy looking, and you never know what kind of path they're going to take. So it doesn't just evenly dissipate within the soil. It kind of, it looks like tree roots, right? It just kind of like jags down in there. So it could have got my stuff. It probably did. Oi, anybody have any advice on that? Let me know. So what do you use for your IP address management, Thomas?
So
is that a loaded question?
All our IP addressing is in NetXMS, which is far from ideal because NetXMS is not natively in the IPAM solution. It does have IPAM-like functionality, and you can do some really nice things in it. And so as to why is because all of our devices are in NetXMS anyway, because they are being monitored from it. So it's basically a very low effort solution to that. It does, you know, it has subnet views, it has some visualization of each subnet, it can find the next free IP address. NetXMS being NetXMS, it automatically learns the entire topology of every single device, so it's very little maintenance, it just works. But it's not a full IPAM solution, which we don't have.
Finally, I found a chink in your armor, buddy.
There's many.
Well, the reason it comes up for me is we've traditionally used IPPLAN, which is an open source project, but it's old, it's clunky, it's not really being maintained anymore, and it kind of was good enough. Well, we've picked up this new customer that we're going to be maintaining the network for. They've got a /20 of public addressing, and then there's going to be some other stuff. And so we needed a way to manage that as well as give them access to it. I didn't really feel comfortable giving them access to IP plan. For one, it looks horrible and it's a little bit clunky, you know, to be honest with you. And so I went with a suggestion I've heard a couple of people, I think Miller and I think Wilson and maybe some other people were talking about PHP IPAM, which is another open source project that seems to be maintained fairly regularly and taken care of. It's got a lot of bells and whistles and features. But you know what? It's so funny is I was looking at it and I just felt exhausted. I was thinking, you know what? It's probably not going to be that hard, but I just don't feel like learning a new IPAM right now. And so I forced myself to install it, installed the Linux server, installed this thing. It didn't take very long. And then to be honest with you, within 15 minutes, I had everything figured out and I had their addressing and stuff in there. It's actually pretty convenient. It's good for them too, because it won't allow them to overlap subnets. Unexpectedly, you can actually track VLANs in there. And since this is really a layer 2 transport network and they just have routers at the data center, you know, they can track their VLANs and they can put their customer subnets in there. It makes it super simple. So I'm a new fan of PHP IPAM. I'm sure there's some additional functionality. It's not the perfect solution, right? I'm sure there is no one perfect solution. Whenever you add a subnet, if you want to associate a VLAN, first you have to go to the VLAN menu, create the VLAN, name it, do all that stuff, and then come back over here and then create the subnet and then assign this thing. I wish you could just say, hey, I'm going to add a VLAN in here. If it doesn't exist, you'll go ahead and create it. I wish, you know, so that I could be maximum lazy.
You know, it's an extra 30 seconds, which is not a big deal. I know it because I'm lazy. But it would also allow them to assign VLANs for new customers, and I can set it so that it'll keep them from overlapping to try and prevent them from accidentally duplicating VLANs when they're doing new customers and stuff like that. So it's pretty neat. I don't know if you've messed with it or the people listening have any interest in it, but I'll say give it a look.
So it's actually on my list of software to check out together with Gestio, I'm not actually sure how to pronounce it, but Gestio IP is another IPAM software solution that's supposedly very competitive with PHP IPAM. So those two are on my list to evaluate and check, but I haven't gotten to that yet.
Gotcha. Well, I'm sure you will give us an update at some point in the somewhat near future, maybe in the next year.
So my plan actually is when we get our new micro cluster running, there I plan to experiment a bunch with various different things and hopefully Gestio and PHP IPAM make that list quite soon.
Very nice. Well, the true test for me is that customer hasn't logged in and tried to use it yet, so... It's one thing for me to figure it out. It's another thing for them. So we'll see how it goes. I actually made them, which I would highly recommend to everyone. Whenever you're trying to onboard a customer to a new technology, is I make a video using Camtasia. And I capture the screen and I do voiceover with this microphone, just like I'm doing now. And then I put it up as unlisted on YouTube, and I send them a link to it so they can always refer back. And usually makes things really simple. I don't know, because I've written, I'm curious what you think about this too. I've written guides, you know, kind of made like wiki articles sort of for guides, and then I've made videos. For me, making a video is way faster, and it seems to work better for some customers. I'm not going to say all, but for quick reference, it seems usually like the written version is a little bit better for me. Like, I would prefer the stuff in writing as opposed to video, but it seems like most of my less technical users really like videos better. What's your estimation?
So I really like both, and it's really greedy because it takes double the time.
Yeah,
but I have a good reasoning for it. So first time when you are getting into a new technology, video is so much better because for overviews, you know, you can have visual and auditory information displayed at the same time. And it's just much easier and faster to understand when you are seeing something and listening to somebody explain it, rather than reading a bunch of text, then switching to screenshots, then, you know, switching back to text. It's cognitively easier to just see it in a video with audio descriptions and the video happening at the same time. But once you get through that and you actually at least understand the technology, you know, you get the basic grasp and understanding of what's going on, then text is so much better because you can use Control F. You know, you can just search for the keywords and whatever. So from the initial video, I will watch it once or twice and I will remember, oh, there's a feature that, you know, accomplishes this, there is that. And the next time I actually want to use that particular feature, I just want to come into a text manual, hit Control F, search a keyword, find it, and do it. And that for me is like the perfect learning process. You know, familiarize yourself with something really fast by having the visual and, you know, video way, and then come back to a text reference guide. But that takes a lot of work too.
Yeah, I think it's great for SEO too. Whenever you do the written form, you know, if somebody's jumping on Google, it's gonna help them get to the answer a lot faster. I think for really quick stuff, because this video was quite literally 70 seconds. You know, to be able to click here, you know, enter in this on one form, and then click save. Right, and so to write out a whole wiki article on just that seemed kind of ridiculous. Plus, they can make their own notes. I'll let them make their own notes. That's what they'll watch the video once and make their own notes. Or they'll ask me for the link again in the near future is probably what's going to happen. Anyway, so a bunch of MikroTik stuff in the list. There was some CVEs, I think like three different ones. It's all based on what Netflix found, some TCP issues in the Linux stack, and MikroTik susceptible to that. Does that sound right?
Well, every single Linux kernel or every single device running Linux kernel is susceptible to that. So it's nothing. Yeah, slightly dangerous. Oops. So it's nothing MikroTik specific. It's done in the Linux kernel. Thank you, Netflix, for finding and publishing all that. So it's just a DOS. So it's not a RCE, remote code execution exploit. It's a DOS exploit, denial of service. So it's not, you know, world ending, but still keep your MikroTik up to date.
Yeah, yeah. I saw they fixed it in 6.45.1, which is the newer one they've released. But I've also heard from several people is that in 6.45.1 they've made some API changes. So So right now, Sonar,
just API, the all radius integration was completely changed. The API was changed. Internal user database was changed, which touches Hotspot, PPPoE. There's basically
Password storage was that change in 6.43 or something?
No, this is all together. It's a single change. Okay. All of that stems from the changes to the user database no longer containing clear text passwords.
Okay, so they changed a lot of things. So one warning I've heard from people is that if you go to 6.45.1 and you're a Sonar user, it's not going to work. Your Sonar is not going to be able to actually
Anything using API will
work. Yeah, so use caution. Any systems that are making API calls, be very careful. So you got to balance that. If you're a big Sonar user, do you want this upgrade or do you want your systems to continue to function? I would say probably the functioning systems is probably your better bet.
Coincidentally, this is one advantage of using CLI, which, for example, Unimus is not affected by this because we use CLI for everything, which people have actually asked us before why we don't use the MikroTik API, and there's many reasons, not just this one, but this is a good example.
Yeah.
When, you know, sometimes using APIs, you know, when they change, suddenly none of your software works. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, you never really win with the CLI. Also, if there are sufficient enough changes inside the CLI, then Unimus would get broken as well. But here, so what's happening here technically is that MikroTik changed the login procedure to the API. So the MikroTik has two APIs. It has a clear text API and then a TSL secured API, which is encrypted, right? And so pretty much everything uses the clear text API, including Sonar, including everything, which is a major drawback because think about it, it's like using Telnet. All of your management goes over an unencrypted channel, which is ridiculous and stupid. But nobody wants to maintain certificates for TLS on, you know, across the network, because that's a huge hurdle. And I don't blame anybody. Since I've started running our own internal CA, it's been so much work to get to the point and to maintain it, etc. That's a different story. I think I mentioned it in one of the previous podcasts previously. But the point is, when you are using MikroTik API or any other ClearText API, is really it's like using Telnet. All of your sensitive data is going through the network in ClearText, which to me is unacceptable. Well, but getting back to...
You can create like a tunnel, right? Or a secure...
Yeah, but then you have to manage the tunnels, there's overhead, and like how ridiculous it is to have to put up a encrypted tunnel just so I can do stuff over the API, right?
Right.
Then if your tunnel breaks for whatever reason, the management sessions no longer work, it's ridiculous. So, but back to the Sonar thing. So what actually happened is that MikroTik changed the login procedure to the API. And here we come back to why I was saying the API is clear text, because obviously sending login passwords to your management interface over clear text is pretty much suicide. So there is a module which uses encryption and hashing and other things for logins to the clear text API. So even though it's a clear text API, the login doesn't expose the clear text password. And MikroTik changed how this login procedure works, and therefore none of the management platforms can log in to the API. The actual structure of the API itself, the entities and data points or paths inside of the API didn't change. It's the login process that changed. And so tying that back into SSH, this is why it's nice to communicate over a protocol, which, you know, the login in SSH will never break because it's part of the SSH standard. So it's a complicated discussion, but yes, none of the management platforms, this is not just Sonar. Any management platform for MikroTik that uses the API will not work with the new versions, and they will have to be readjusted.
To your knowledge, did MikroTik disseminate that information, the change of API, before they actually did release?
Oh, yes. They've been advertising this for at least 2 months at
all
this point.
So all these vendors, theoretically...
They had 2 months to prepare.
At least.
Probably more, but... me personally, I have been aware of this at least 2 months.
Okay. Yeah, see, so a lot of people like to jump the gun and get angry at vendors for, you know, sometimes MikroTik will make changes in versions that surprise people, but this one, at least, they had some forethought and they were warning people of it. That's good.
All right.
So I don't want to hear anybody complain about it. About MikroTik not telling everybody, because apparently they did. So there you go.
They definitely did.
All right. So I also was doing some rogue DHCP on like a CRS 100 something. And I'm not a huge fan of the CRS 100 or 200 series. I like the 300 stuff. In there, if you so it was a guy had a network, he had somebody plug in a router backwards, you know, a home router, and so it started offering DHCP to his network, and that's a rogue DHCP, and so he wanted to block it, and MikroTik added the rogue DHCP or the DHCP snooping feature, which basically blocks rogues. Whenever you add that to the CRS 100 or 200 series, it turns off hardware forwarding, which is bad. But I found if you use a bridge filter to block the rogue DHCP, it continues to do hardware forwarding and seems to work okay. So it's a roundabout way of accomplishing the same thing, because I think their DHCP snooping is just a checkbox now, and you tell it which interface, you know, the DHCP server should be coming from, and it's really easy. But a temporary workaround, or I guess it's probably not temporary, because I don't think they're going to add that functionality to the older series of stuff. There you go.
Realistically, what you are doing, though, at least from what I understand, is not really DHCP snooping. You are just blanket blocking DHCP requests or responses on certain ports.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit different, but accomplishes the same thing.
It's not ideal, but it gets the job done, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, in essence, that is what DHCP snooping does. Although DHCP snooping is usually a bit more complicated, because you can like attach options to DHCP requests and responses and stuff like that, which is obviously not what you had, what you needed.
Yeah.
Just maybe a slight note. Off top of my head, I think there are limits on the CRS 1 and 2 series that you can only have like the first 10 or 20 bridge filters are hardware forwarded. There is a limit, because they are setting it into the ASIC, and the ASIC can only handle so many rules in hardware. So just a note there.
Good tip. Yeah, I know bridge or DHCP snooping and other vendors kind of build a table internally that can be shared by other services on that switch. Like in Cisco, you could share it with dynamic ARP inspection. Actually, you have to use it. If you want to turn on dynamic ARP inspection, you have to use it in conjunction with DHCP.
Which is super useful, and I would recommend everybody to do that.
Yeah. So it's useful from a lot of vendors. And doesn't everybody pretty much universally call it DHCP snooping? Does anybody else call it something else?
No.
All right. Good deal. So a quick Google of DHCP snooping and your model of device should yield you something out there that you can get. Yeah, definitely use it with caution, because you can tank your whole network pretty easily. That's fun. Like,
but then, again, you are protecting your whole network from somebody else tanking it.
Yeah. Well, like I was testing dynamic ARP inspection one time, and I forgot to turn on DHCP snooping, and it lets you add it, and then it just blocks all traffic through the switch. I was like, that's bad. At least give me a pop-up or something. It was in like a portion of the network where it didn't really matter, which is why I was doing it over there. But still.
And if we are talking about L2 protections, so what I usually do, or what I would recommend, is turn on dynamic ARC protection, turn on DHCP snooping, and turn on MAC address limit on ports which you know have end devices connected to them.
Yeah. What does Cisco call that? Port security? Mm-hmm. Like the number of MACs you can actually learn on an interface, all that stuff. Which, it's funny, because it can be a pain in the butt sometimes, and so people will just want to rip all of that stuff out, and sometimes it can really save you, especially on untrusted networks, right? It can protect you from a lot of annoying kids doing annoying things.
So I think it's okay. I don't want to, you know, put it like a blanket statement, because there are obviously exceptions, but I think it's better to block something than to just, you know, even if you are blocking something that's legit, rather to not have protection and allow everything, right? So your default security, what do we even call it? Like your default security prerogative should be drop everything and only allow the stuff that you want to have, right? And as I said, I don't want that to be a blanket statement, because there are obvious caveats to that, and it takes a lot of work to make it happen. But it's just like with firewalls, right? What you are supposed to do is, you know, by default, drop all of the traffic and only allow the traffic you want to have. And it should be very similar at layer 2. You know, you want to secure the ports as best as you can, and then if something doesn't work, you know, they can always tell you, and you can make more things work. It's easy to add more access or add more MAC addresses to a port. Of course, it's annoying when people have to tell you that something doesn't work and you have to manually fix it, but then again, you are gaining a lot of security and stability in a network by having that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm trying to think of scenarios where I've seen people argue against this stuff. I've seen, what was it, a team of two guys that were administering, I don't know, several thousand users, and these guys over here would complain about something, so they'd have to start trying to make this exclusion, and then while they're over here trying to put out fires, and you know, so I've seen guys just go in and just, you know what, forget it, and they'll just wipe everything off the switch, all of those security protection mechanisms, and they say, is it working now? Okay, and then they'll move on to something else, and then they never come back.
The thing is, this way you are just making room for more fires in the future.
Yeah.
And it's not easy if you are in a situation where, you are two guys running a massive network and you have very little time and very little resources. But you have to think for yourself, you know, what if somebody at 1 a.m. takes down a leg of a network because they create a loop, or because they, you know, plug in their router the other way around and start hijacking addresses, or even worse, what if somebody maliciously starts hijacking the gateway and other things, you know?
Or DHCP starvation, or anything.
There's a million of layer 2 attacks. There really is. There is so many layer 2
and they're attacks. So simple to accomplish, too.
So simple. It's a single line in Linux shell, literally. It's a single line. So, it's more work up front, but by securing it and doing it properly up front, you save yourself the fires in the future, and you save yourself the time to fix it and implement it properly anyway in the future. So why not just do it right in the first place and avoid downtime, avoid customer dissatisfaction, and avoid your own work and fires into the future?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think some people too, if they're running a network and, you know, it's not like theoretically customer facing, if you're just managing your users inside, sometimes they don't think of their users as customers, right? So they treat them differently. They treat them as just employees inside the company.
But it's not even about the employees, right? The employees are, any security expert will tell you that the user is always the weakest link.
Oh, absolutely.
And you know, it's so easy to get to get a rootkit or remote code execution on Jesus, on anything today. Everything is network connected, from your printers through stupid IoT stuff, through all the cloud solutions and everything else. It's so easy to just get a attack point inside of the network, either through the user or a phishing attack or whatever, or through some device inside of the network. And once I am in and you don't have those restrictions and protections, then, you know, the network is mine, literally. Speaking of, we don't have this in the notes, but there was a huge, huge exploit and leak of an IoT company this week. A Chinese IoT company which manages 100 plus million IoT devices left their device database fully opened on the internet. It's the usual, you know, Elasticsearch default default deploy unsecured on a public IP address. Wow. Some security researchers found it. 100 million plus records, IP addresses, usernames, passwords, reset codes to IoT devices and user accounts that were using those IoT devices through that Chinese company. It doesn't matter if it's a Chinese company or an American company. Right. It doesn't matter. This has happened so many times to American companies, European companies, Australian Chinese companies. It doesn't matter. The point is, a huge leak happened this week. Yeah, it's still this week, yeah. So that's just an example of, you know, you can have a light bulb that's an IoT light bulb that connects to a cloud, so, or a thermostat or a doorbell or whatever that connects to the cloud. It's an IoT thing, but it's inside of your network. And if somebody breaches that, they are inside of your network.
Yeah, you're toast. I mean, that's, what was it, like that Target leak? It was an HVAC guy that came in to work on the system, and that's how they ended up getting in the back. So it's, yeah.
So actually, I'm not sure which one you're referring to, but the big Target hack was because their POS terminals, their, you know, point of sale systems, basically their like the cashier desks, were not separated in a separate VLAN. So their cashier machines were basically on the corporate office network with like the accountants and managers' computers and everything else, and somebody just stuck a USB drive into one of the POS terminals, which was running Windows XP, which was vulnerable. They gained a full access to that POS Windows XP machine, and since they were on the corporate network, which was attached to all of the other corporate networks through VPN, they basically, from a single POS cashier machine, they gained access to the entire Target network. So I am not sure which one you were referring
That's
to.
That's bananas.
That was the big Target hack a couple of years ago. There is post-mortem analysis, and there is, you know, all kinds of analysis of how that happened. But yeah, they basically didn't separate their cashier POS systems onto a separate VLAN, and that allowed an attacker to hijack the entirety of Target.
And there you go. Oh, good times. So, moving on from security, Nick Ariolano was talking about looking glasses, which are kind of independent views into routing tables, like BGP tables. And so most major carriers have their own, and then there's some independent ones. My personal favorite is RouteViews. I think it's routeviews.org. They maintain some routers out there that you can like telnet into and issue commands. I like it because they're very Cisco-like, and I can get a viewpoint. So the idea being, this router peers with just tons of other networks, and so you get a really good view of what the internet looks like from their perspective. So, of course, as soon as I said RouteViews, Nick B., had to start name dropping about how, you know, he's like all cool and connected with these projects and he can make stuff happen. Of course, now I'm just playing. Nick's a super, super cool guy. I just thought that was, I'm kind of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon away from that project, which I think is really cool. But whenever you're making BGP changes, I usually drop into RouteViews just to make sure that everything's propagating out of all of the upstreams that I'm anticipating them coming from, right? So if there's a filter problem or one of your upstreams is for whatever reason, they haven't updated their filters, you can see, hey, I'm not learning this, or rather this subnet's not being learned from these providers. So what is your favorite looking glass? Like, what do you usually use over there in Europe?
I really like the Hurricane Electric one because it gives you super nice visualizations. So it's not just command line. Of course, it's just from one point of view because it's Hurricane Electric's looking glass. But they visualize the stuff so well, like the interconnections between ASs and how traffic paths are selected, etc. So I really like the Hurricane Electric one.
If you wanted kind of a route views equivalent, is there one over there in Europe that you guys use?
I don't know of any.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe somebody listening knows of it and they could send us a link.
Oh, yeah, let us know.
It is invaluable. So another Thomas tidbit that we got this week is HFS web server, which is ironic because I've been using that thing for a million years and I never thought to use it to test ports through a firewall because HFS is what, like a standalone executable? And when it starts up, you can just say, hey, run on this port, and then you can test if your firewall actually has that port open or not.
Yeah, it's just a super simple and super comfortable way to test NAT or port forwards. And this all came because Mike was asking, you know, what is the easiest way to validate if a port forward is correctly set up. And yeah, just fire up HFS, send it to that port, and it will give you a web interface if your firewall and NAT is configured correctly. And it takes under a minute and super easy to test.
Yeah, and it's something you could have a remote user that's not super technically savvy download this thing and then start up so that you could test, right?
Yeah, definitely. And if you are on Linux, then just Python-m http.server. It's basically the same thing. It's just a simple HTTP server in a single line of shell on Linux.
Very nice. You're always full of good advice. Speaking of good advice, I have the current need to physically secure some access points. So they're going to be HAPAC2s. Yeah, the little guys. I have to physically secure them, as in not keep people from doing intrusion, but keep people from picking them up and walking away with them. So it's in kind of an open environment-ish. Not really. Sort of. Anyway, my idea was going to be find some company that sells some pre-made product that I can just super glue onto the side of the router and then attach it to somewhere else. But everywhere I found those, they're at least $10. And when you're paying $50 for the router, it's crazy to think you're going to pay one-fifth the price for this thing. You know, I'd rather, you know, if I'm putting 100 out there, odds are maybe one a year is going to walk away. So price-wise, that doesn't make any sense. So I was thinking about super gluing just a galvanized washer to the side of this thing, using some steel braided cable and crimping it around the washer and then around something else to physically secure it. Have you ever had to physically secure a device like that that wasn't super expensive, so you didn't want to put like a lot of like a cage around it or anything? But
yeah, normally my answer would be, you know, there is a standard for this, which is called the Kensington standard, and there is, well, it's, I suppose it's not really a standard, it's just an industry standard, but there is a Kensington standard, which they sell Kensington locks, mm-hmm. Kensington chains, and all of this. Mm-hmm. And more expensive devices have like built-in Kensington.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
It's just kind of a small rectangular hole, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a standard that, you know, when you buy a device that says it has a Kensington lock on it, then mm-hmm. you buy a cable, and you know it will go in, and it will just everything. Works, but yeah, that's not for a HAP. It's much more expensive, so I have not have to deal with this yet. I mean, I would say just like drill a hole through the side of it and then stick a metal cable in it and be done with it.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, but I don't know what looks less tacky, a galvanized washer painted black, glued to the outside, or a hole drilled in it with the cable going through that. Like, I'm not really sure.
What I would do is, you know, like you have the side of the box, right? And you just drill through like a... I don't know if I will be able to describe this in words. A picture would be better. But yeah, I would just drill through like two holes diagonally through one of the corners and just stick the cable through it. So it looks like, you know, diagonally through the angle at the corner. Stick a cable in there, maybe that wouldn't be too tacky.
I think it would look pretty clean. It's going to be super inexpensive if I just get steel braided cable and then loop it through and crimp it. I mean, and it'll be satisfactory. If somebody rips it out of the wall, it's not that big a deal, right? I can replace it. It's a deterrent. So I might lose one a year if I. They're not. I mean, these are. Nobody's going to take these things because all the people that are going to this place.
I'll tell you how to secure it. Just plug in the Ethernet and break the make it so you can't unplug the cable. You know, the Ethernet cables have the little guards. Just make that guard permanent, not clickable down, so you can't take out the Ethernet cable, and the Ethernet cable will be a. We'll hold it in place.
Ugh, but if they rip out the RJ45 out of the wall, that's going to be a huge pain in the butt for me. I mean, it's a pain in the butt either way. I guess that's an option, too. Either way,
Vetnik engineering,
it's
right?
Annoying or, either way. Yeah. So.
Or just super glue the Ethernet jack in it.
Yeah. To be honest with you, it's not like the cable's going to go bad because it's not moving. Yeah. It's just stationary. So I could just super glue it in. On both sides, and if it ever goes bad, then all I have to do is just replace the wall port, and I could have one. I don't know, man. We'll see. I'll see what I end up doing. Drilling the holes wouldn't be bad. I could just set up. I could make a little jig and just hit it on the drill press super fast. Each one just.
Well, if you've got 100 of them, that's like solid. You know, maybe 3 hours of work. Which, if you think like $100 an hour, that's $300 just for the work.
I don't know. If I'm setting up a jig, each one will probably take 15 seconds to drill a hole.
Times 100.
And then you got to run the cable through and crimp. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I could. I've got some nephews. I've got some slave labor.
Perfect work for a cheap, cheap workforce.
I get it done. I was just curious if you'd run into physically securing an access point in that way. I mean, there's a USB port on top. Maybe I could super glue a cable into that or something. It's not like they're going to need to use that. Actually, it's probably better that they don't have access to that. I'm trying to charge my phone on this router. It's not working. Oh, golly. All right. So something else that Nick B, and I'm saying B because I can never remember how to properly pronounce his last name, is I think Italian last name. Was
you mean Buraglio? Buraglio?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, Nick.
Or yeah, I mean it's something like that.
I think
that.
It's Buraglio.
Alright, that sounds right. Alright. We engaged in a fairly lengthy discussion about the Verizon Verizon issues that happened a week ago. I don't know. I can't remember. It wasn't that long ago. In essence, Verizon had a customer that was leaking, I think, the full internet route table back into them.
Yep.
And I think they said it came down to a route optimizer having a problem.
Yep.
All right. So, Nick, and I hate putting words in other people's mouths, but I want to say the gist of his concerns were, you shouldn't manipulate any information that's given to you, right? So most route optimizers, at least the ones I'm familiar with, what they do is they take a subnet. If they want to optimize that subnet, say it's a /24 and they want to optimize it. Say it's going to the left right now. They want it to go to the right. What they'll do is they'll take that subnet and they'll slash it, or they'll cut it into 2/25s and they'll advertise it being sourced from the right side, right? So now traffic sees that as a more specific route, and so it's going to shift over there. So Nick is a big proponent of leaving traffic alone, right? If it's not originated from you, if it's not your route, you shouldn't be manipulating in that way, right? Like cutting routes up and chopping them up and doing weird stuff with them. And ultimately, those more preferred routes that the route optimizer made, I think, were what got leaked in there, really causing havoc, right? Because a shorter route is going to be more preferred, right? More specific route, I should say, it's going to be preferred. And when you start manipulating that stuff and you advertise it out, things can get a little weird. So me personally, I totally understand the idea of leaving traffic alone. But sometimes, hear me out, sometimes people find themselves in interesting situations. And situationally, I think sometimes route optimizers are the best answer you can have, right? It may not be, it may not be the purest. So for me, in my network, the data center networks, we offer insane SLAs, right? So we have to maintain those as good as possible. So a lot of route optimizers, what they do is they also not just try, I mean, one thing they do is they try and save you money, right? So a route optimizer will, you put all of your circuits in there. Say I've got four circuits. Say 1 through 4, I arrange them by who gives me the cheapest price. And so a route optimizer can actually monitor how much traffic's moving through there. And it can shift traffic over to your cheaper links until they get close to breaching your 95th percentile. And then it can kind of move traffic back over, right? In essence, it can save you money. So that's one reason people use route optimizers. Two is if you've got some special services, say you've got a hosted VoIP provider you use out on the internet, you can actually put their route, their specific subnet in your optimizer, and it can watch that subnet. And it can test to that destination out of all of your upstream providers, and it can optimize that traffic. So if all of a sudden it sees failure going, you know, out of the normal path that the internet wants to take, it can split that route into two and then shift it over to somebody that actually is working, right? So that's great. It can actually help you route around failure. And in the case that I use it for primarily is it's constantly monitoring traffic out of all of my upstreams. I've had issues before where back in the day I had Level 3 as one of my providers, and they turned up a new peering point in Chicago, and here I am in Texas and I'm peering with them in Texas, and all of a sudden 40% of my traffic just starts going into the toilet because of that peering issue they had up in Chicago. I think they had multiple links fail simultaneously, and so it was just overloading one of the remaining links. So, you know, there was that. I've had issues where the router I was peering with locked up in bizarre ways. I've had issues where a provider turned up a new 10 gig circuit to, I think, Montreal, and that became best path for a region of the South for like 45 minutes or something. And so, you know, you're trying to shove, you know, 4 or 5 states through a single 10 gig pipe up in Canada, you're going to have problems. So what my forward-looking optimizer does is it tests out of all of my peers. So what a lot of these things do is you dump NetFlow back to this collector, and it's just a server that's sitting there, right? Your optimizer. The collector will look at that NetFlow, and it'll look at, and they're all different, say the top 1,000 destinations every minute. And it will actually do, say, TCP tests out to those top 1,000 destinations, so it can actually see what the round trip time is, right? ICMP can sometimes be preferred by a vendor, or some routers will give it a really low precedence, so it's not always a true gauge of what's happening on the TCP stack. So it'll test their TCP, and if it sees a significant amount of failure through any one of those peers, it can run a script. And what my script does is it prepends, I think, 6 times out of that carrier, right? So it's a much less preferred route. Now it looks so far away that nobody actually sends anything inbound to me. And I dump all of the routes except for the default route, and I set the preference super low on that. So the idea being, if everything else failed, I'd go back to this provider that's causing me problems. But in essence, it's pulled out of the mix. And so when you're a single provider and it's 3 a.m. and you get a call and you've got multiple upstreams, you can't always immediately discern who's giving you the problems, right? So if you have a route optimizer, he's always awake, he's always looking at your traffic, and instead of taking 20 minutes to respond at 3 a.m., he takes 15 seconds, and he will pull that bad player out of the mix, right? So that's how I use an optimizer. So it's kind of, while I understand Nick's perspective, I also understand that sometimes people have insane SLAs they've got to maintain, and sometimes they have small staffs. Everybody's got a small staff, what am I talking about? And, you know, if you need to employ something that operates quickly, automation is the way to go. Now, I don't really like the idea of splitting routes in half and doing all that stuff, but I also take precautions to prevent that. So one thing I do is I put a community on everything that's learned from my optimizer, because it does all this via BGP. And I filter that, so it only lives on my backbones. It's not allowed to go to any providers. It's not allowed to go to any customers, and it never leaves the backbones. So I try and isolate it as much as possible, right, to protect everything else. But it has saved me so many times as compared to how many issues I've had with it, which is very few. So I don't know, right? I think it's hard to be, I think this is a very, at least for me, this is a gray area, right? My brain says no, but my heart says yes. I think optimizer is the way to go for some people. And I think you can do it safely in some situations, right? Verizon, obviously they didn't have filtering set up right. Which is tough for the big carriers, right? I mean, have you done any research on, what is it, RPKI, Thomas?
Yeah. And so actually my viewpoint on this is a little bit different as well.
All right.
It doesn't really matter that this was an optimizer. Optimizer is just a means to an end, a means to manipulating the global routing table. And honestly, there is literally thousands of people in the world right now that if they wanted to, they could redirect the entire internet traffic to themselves. That's just a fact, simply because there is no filtering like there wasn't in Verizon, right? So it doesn't matter if this was an optimizer. It really doesn't. If it was an administrator making a wrong configuration, which we've seen happen tens of times, yeah, over the last just couple of years. It doesn't matter if it's an optimizer, it doesn't matter if it's an administrator or a government, if it's malicious or not, because route hijacks are often used for basically transparent traffic hijacking for malicious purposes. It doesn't matter. It's the inherent error was in Verizon not having proper route filtering and security measures in place. That's it. Verizon really should be doing better. It should either have RPKI, there is so many, just, I know it's not easy for a major carrier to do proper full filtering, but it's their responsibility to do so, and they should do so. And if everybody was, everybody being a internet citizen, by which I mean being an SA, a network, internet networking citizen, being an SA, if every SA was responsible enough and implemented those best practices in the manners, manners shortcut, the manners document, then it wouldn't matter if it's an optimizer, if it's an administrator, if it's a malicious entity, it wouldn't matter because it would not be possible. So to me, this is not an issue of, is an optimizer a good thing or a bad thing? To me, this is very simple. Verizon should do better.
Yeah, and on my networks, whenever we have customers connect in, I manually put filters in there, right? So I limit what they can actually send me. And then to my anybody upstream from me, I put filters limiting what I can actually send to them. I'm not making changes constantly throughout the day, right? So I can't even imagine being in a network like that and even remotely for a second thinking that you could manually do some of this stuff. But there are some protection mechanisms, right? Because this was a single customer, right, where they could have put some filtering in place, right?
Yeah, there's so many things they could do. They know, this customer should never be redirecting the entirety of the state US traffic to them, right? They should have a number of prefixes this customer can issue. There's simple things you can do,
yeah,
that you don't have to adjust daily. There is how many prepends they can do, how many prefixes they can originate. There is just simple things. Even if you are not doing the full filtering of, what can I receive from this? Yes, as I said, I understand that's hard on the scale of Verizon, but there is so many simple ways which could have prevented this, which don't need the micromanagement of, manually specifying which prefixes an AS can originate, that could have prevented this. So I'm sorry, it's for me, it's hard to find any sympathy with Verizon because they literally did nothing. They did nothing to prevent this, and that's not okay in my book.
Yeah, I have problems finding sympathy in there too. When you're one of the major carriers and your profits are in the billions, and you're really, your one job, at least for this organization, was to, you know, be resilient, provide the internet and stuff like that. You got to think they could have spent, you know, a few million of their profits and put some kind of system in place for this. So I don't know. It just seems like something that was preventable. But you know what? I'm sure they'll learn a lesson, and hopefully they will improve, continual improvement, right?
Let's hope so.
All right. So let's take a little trip to the Thomas Corner. Is what you lovingly referred to it as in the doc. So is this the corner of Thomas and Rant? Is that sort of geographically where we're going?
Honestly, it's just what has been going on in Thomas's professional life in the last month corner.
All right. Well, tell me about your Linux desktop.
All right. So I got pissed off, seriously pissed off at Microsoft. specifically at Windows 10 desktop. And I just couldn't take it anymore. I mean, the constant upgrades, the constant reboots, the constant patches, the constant security issues, which I'm not saying Linux doesn't have. It's just... Okay, so after the latest 1903 patch in Windows, I have been running out of memory on my desktop every day. Literally every day. I have 32 gigs of RAM, and I have been running out of memory and needing to reboot daily. Something is memory leaking, and I have no way in Windows to figure out what, because the task manager doesn't show me anything. I looked into the non-page, the pool, I looked everywhere. Simply, there is not enough tools in Windows today, because Windows does a lot of memory caching. Basically, the philosophy of Microsoft is, you know, ooh, if you are not using your memory, it's just sitting there and doing nothing, and it's useless. So they preload, basically, automatically, algorithmically, they preload what they think you are using actively into RAM. Hmm. But the point is, of course, when another application needs that RAM, you know, that preloaded space should be emptied out, and that space should be made available to actual applications running and the memory. So I think there is a bug somewhere in the preload mechanism that wasn't freeing memory, and there, whatever, it doesn't matter. The point is, I just had enough. I had to reboot my desktop, and this was, everything was fine before the 1903 upgrade. After 1903, which is, yeah, bad. But still, even before that, I, you know, don't you just hate it when you leave your computer, you go out of work, you go home, you leave everything set up, and you come in the morning and find out that Windows has rebooted your computer for you, and, you know, now everything is gone and stuff is screwed up. And I had multiple issues where, you know, it didn't reopen the applications and the Windows, or, you know, Chrome couldn't deal with reboots properly. And basically, I got pissed off at Windows. So over the years, I've multiple times basically tested out running either Ubuntu desktop or Mint or other things on my computer, but in the end always came back to Windows. Well, not anymore. So about 3 weeks ago, I completely migrated over the course of about 3 days my primary computer, my primary desktop that I use about 12 hours a day, which is my work computer. I've migrated into Manjaro, then it's spelling that in English will be hard. XFCE, yeah, Manjaro XFCE. Manjaro is basically just an offshoot of Arch, I think, Linux. So it's just a desktop Linux distribution that's really nice, well-packaged, well-rounded up, and stable. And man, I am happy. I have to say, the Linux desktop has come a long way just in the last 5 years. because I think like the last time I was seriously trying to use Linux on desktop was about 5 years ago with Ubuntu desktop, which was running their Unity shell back in the day. And then I tried Mint with their Cinnamon, DE desktop environment, and I didn't like either of those. There were things which didn't work. Anyway, so I migrated this time around to Manjaro XFCE, and it's wonderful. I love it. Everything works pretty much out of the box. It's very nice. It's very user-friendly. It's Linux, so it's completely customizable. I can do anything I want. Like, I have mapped custom keyboard shortcuts and just utility stuff which I use. Like, hello?
Lost you for a second.
I think I dropped idea for a second. I basically mapped all of my applications which I use daily to hotkeys. So like Control-Alt-W, it's a new Firefox instance. Control-Alt-E is a new LastPass vault and stuff like that. And I love it. And honestly, Vine is an acronym for Vine is not an emulator. So it's a Windows compatibility layer for Linux, which allows you to run any Windows application on Linux itself. And Vine is great. It has also made so much progress in the last few years. I just like everything about it. I love it. And I made a joke that Vine is better Windows than Windows. Because, honestly, okay, so how Vine works, basically, it gives you the ability to make, they call it a prefix, but really it's like a sandbox. So you can create as many Vine sandboxes or environments, however you want to call it. Let's call it environment from now on. They call it prefix. Let's call it environment. So you can make how many you want Vine environments, and then you install stuff into the Vine environments. So, for example, you want a .NET framework. Let's say you want to run a Windows application which requires .NET framework 4.2 specifically. So you create a new Vine environment, you install .NET 4.2 in it, and then you deploy your application in it. And now you need another application which needs .NET 4.7. So you just spin up a new environment, install .NET 4.7, and deploy that application in there. And they don't interfere with each other. And once you are done using that application that required .NET 4.2, you just delete that environment. And that deletes, the application, the .NET framework, everything that ever happened inside of that Vine environment. And you don't have to deal with, incompatibilities between Microsoft crap and, upgrades of .NET environments and stuff like that. You need VC redistributables, the Microsoft Visual C redistributables. Okay, you can install one per environment on each application needing VC redistributable 2015 that runs in that environment, all the applications needing the 2017 run in a different environment. It's beautiful. It's separated. And so what is super funny about this, we have, and why I'm saying, why I made the joke that Vine is better Windows than Windows, we compile Unimus into EXEs, into, we have Windows distributions. We have a portable Windows distribution and we have a Windows installer. The compilation of Windows EXEs works in Vine, and not just that, I can run a Windows EXE natively in Vine using Windows Java, all in Linux. I love it. I love it. It's so basically, I completely migrated my desktop to Linux. I love it, and I have zero issues with it. Even Windows stuff works without any issues. It's fully customizable. Upgrades are wonderful because it's just package upgrades. Every single package has a changelog, and reboots are wonderful. So basically, I can reboot, I can be in any state on my desktop, have, 20 Firefox windows open, 5 documents, 10 instances of, developer of IDs, developer environments for Java. Whatever I have, I press reboot, within 20 seconds I am exactly back where I started. All the windows are positioned into right virtual desktops, or workspaces if you want. They're in the right positions, right sizes. Basically, I can make a reboot of my Linux machine and be back within 20 seconds without even knowing I rebooted. It's magic. I love it. I love it. So I have now become one of those people that, one of those crazy people that run Linux on their main desktop. And I am afraid I am becoming one of those crazy people that will tell you how good it is and will constantly now make snide remarks and Windows people how they should migrate to Linux.
Gotcha. So you're basically a Mac user is what you're telling me.
Yeah, but with Linux.
So other than Winbox, what are you running in Wine?
Yeah, definitely Winbox, of course. Then I run Skite, which is the development environment for the Windows stuff that we do. I run a Windows Java in it. I run a Git client in it, simply because I haven't found a better Linux Git client yet. I haven't had time to look, really. And honestly, that's about it. I think that's the only three applications that I run on the EXEs inside of Vine.
Do you use Google Docs? Is that what you do for your word processing and Excel?
No. So this is one thing which I will give Microsoft. Office is a better word processor than anything that is out there. I hate Google Docs. I really don't like them. They don't have enough functionality, specifically the Google Excel, the sheets.
Sheets, yeah.
They don't do it for me. Also, the PowerPoint, the Google Present or whatever, it doesn't do it for me either. Not enough functionality. It's too cut down. Also, there is the fact that all of your documents are in Google and Google actively reads them and parses them. Yes, they do. Google actively reads and parses every single document, every single email you have in your inbox. And marketers actually actively use this. Google sells this in their adverts and AdSense, that marketers can market to you based on the contents of your inbox and of your Google documents. And no, I am not willing to give our proprietary company information to Google. Anyway, back to that. This is hard, but I have been trying to switch to OpenOffice or LibreOffice. It also doesn't work for me. I haven't decided what to do yet. So for now, I have been using the the Office Online, which is no better than Google because it's still Microsoft Online. So for like trivial documents, I have been using the Office Online, and for like work documents which have sensitive data in them, I have just been RDPing into my home machine, which still runs Windows. So I haven't fully solved or decided on how to solve that yet.
Well, I mean, at home you're still playing games and stuff like that too, right? And I'm guessing you need Windows to run Steam and all those games. And
so actually, this is funny because Steam works on Linux without an issue, and there is Proton. Proton, I think that's how you pronounce it in English, Proton, which is basically a compatibility layer from Valve, the company behind Steam, right? Which allows you to play a majority of the Steam library on Linux. But that's fine for the games themselves, but the games I play often run different things along the game. For example, I play a lot of Path of Exile, which has external applications to it, like trade macros and just other things which use auto hotkey and other things, which by the way, this is not breaking the EULA of the game. It's all approved by the developers of the game of Path of Exile. So I play Path of Exile, I play Forge Alliance Forever, which is this is super old game, Supreme Commander, which came from Total Annihilation. If anybody remembers the old Annihilation series, I loved it. I play Supreme Commander, or what it has become, Forge Alliance Forever it's called now. I play that a lot. I love it. It's like a macro based strategy. You have real-time strategies. RTS is like StarCraft, which are super micro based, whereas Forge Alliance Forever is macro-based. So you don't really micro the units, you macro the economy. It's a very different kind of RTS game. The point is, those games will really not run in Linux anytime soon. So yes, I'm still running Windows for my home desktop, which I use very little.
All right, well, I guess the real test is if you're still using it in 6 months.
Yeah. I mean, so I've now been using it for 3 weeks, 12 plus hours a day, and so far I am very happy. I haven't had a need to even install a Windows virtual machine yet. Everything I do is Linux native, and I love it so far. So I really hope I don't run into any issues and don't leave it.
I believe in you. You've got stick-to-itiveness. So tell me about the new version of Radman, because you just put out like 1.02 or something, right?
So actually, I think on the last podcast, Radman was not yet a public product at all. So in the last month, I think about 3 weeks ago, we released Radman, and this is completely free and open source. It's on GitHub. It's not paid. It's free. And Radman, it's basically a RADius manager. So it's a free RADius management GUI. And we released it out there, see if people are interested, if they like it. And basically it just came from, well, maybe we have talked
about it. Yeah, we talked about it. You just didn't have the documentation written yet.
Oh, yeah. So now it's fully public. It's fully documented. It's fully, you know, it's a production-grade product now. We actually have multiple people now in our Slack are running it. I also have one really big customer that is already running it in production. And 2 days ago, on Friday, we released version 1.01. So the first bug fix patch, which was, you know, just fixes for the initial issues. And so far, the reception of Radman and people running it has been good. And yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I want to hear more people using it. So tell me about Unimus 1.10.2. And actually, for the one person out there that doesn't know what Unimus is, how would you describe it in 30 seconds?
So basically, Unimus is a automation and configuration management platform for networking equipment. And so while that is super abstract, basically there is four things it does. So number one is automation, mass configuration push. Let's say you need to deploy a VLAN to 200 switches, press a button, it will do it for you. Change a password across the network, press a button, it will do it for you. It also does backups, so configuration backup, change management and change notifications. So my 30 seconds are up. Damn it. Anyway.
I like it. Yeah, you're talking about change management and notification.
Configuration management platform, yeah.
Yeah, whenever, so it pushes to our Slack every day. So whenever it runs, it actually will spit out a report that says this number of devices were backed up. These are the ones you had problems with, and you can kind of go, or this many had changes, and shows you all that stuff. So it's really cool. I like that. Not only does it do it, but it tells you about it.
So anyway, yeah, there was a, so this release we've actually been working on for about more than a month. It's a really big bug fix patch release. So it's not like a feature release, it's a bug fix release. And yeah, it's we fixed quite a few issues. So anybody running Unimus, please upgrade to the latest 1.10.2 release. And that's about it. Like, there is nothing exciting in the change log. It's just a big list of fixes for issues and bugs, and yeah.
Sweet action. All right. Oh, you loosened up. You ready for that rant? All right. Tell me about dealing with CAs as a non-US company.
All right. So all of this goes back to Microsoft. So over the last couple of years, probably more than that, multiple times the Windows distributions of Unimus were flagged by Microsoft Windows Defender as a virus. And it's a false positive detection, but we've reported it to Defender, we've tried to get them to whitelist us and all of that, but Microsoft is a super huge corporation and they don't give a crap about the tiny Slovakian software company whose product is getting marked as a virus by Defender.
Imagine that.
Imagine that, yeah. So, one thing we can do about it is get a code signing certificate and actually code sign our releases, which may or may not help the Defender false positives. It may or may not, but so okay, we should really code sign our releases in the first place. Yes, I am not saying no. The truth is, it really will not help security of our releases, because we already release, like, our only release channel is our website, and that's HTTPS, so we don't release through third parties, we don't upload our build to third parties, etc. So realistically, there is minimal security benefit to code signing because there is no way that somebody external would be able to manipulate our distribution axes. But yeah, so we wanted, or I wanted to start code signing our releases. Hopefully it will help with the false positives on Defender. So I actually already looked into this about a year ago. And after I saw everything that is needed to get the code signing certificate, a year ago I just said, screw it, we are not doing it. It was too much effort. And so now, a year later, I started looking at it again. First of all, because it adds professionalism and it adds, it should be done. We should do it for Windows. That's the end of it, right? It adds professionalism, it adds trust in our product, and it might help with the Defender false positives. So it turns out, and as I said, I already dealt with this a year ago, now I'm dealing with it again. It turns out getting a code signing certificate as a non-US company is ridiculously, stupidly, I don't want to say hard, it's just, okay, let me explain maybe for people who don't understand how certificates and specifically code signing certificates work. So code signing certificate is just a certificate that you use to, it's not an encryption certificate like you use for, you know, your HTTPS servers for Apache or Nginx. That's a little bit different because those certificates are TSL server certificates. A code signing certificate signs something to prevent manipulation and to basically verify the identity of something. So it's not an encryption certificate, it's a signing certificate. And code signing certificates are used by software companies to sign their compiled product to make sure that the product came from the company, it's the original release, it hasn't been modified, etc. So code signing certificates are of course issued by certificates authorities or CAs. A certificate authority is basically a company that has some processes in place that goes through some basic security audits and submits their root certificate authority certificates to the certificate trust stores of various operating systems. To make it simple, there is a company, they are a certificate authority, they issue code signing certificates, and then, you know, those certificates get validated in your operating system like Windows or Linux or whatever. The thing is, those companies, the CAs, they basically get access to money printing machines. Literally, what certificate authorities do, they print money. Why? Because when I want a certificate, I have to pay for it. And so I pay a certificate authority, and all they do is issue a certificate. And they can issue unlimited number of certificates to unlimited number of people, and people pay for it. It's a money printing machine, literally. And I know it's not that simple because they have to, you know, there are extended validation certificates where they actually have to do validation. There are rules, there are audits, they have to, you know, they have to basically comply with certain security policies, blah, blah, blah. They have to publish and maintain certificate revocation lists, but still, it's a money printing machine. You give them $500 for a code signing certificate, and it costs them nothing to issue it. Literally nothing. It's like 0.001 cent in electricity that you know the processor cycles take to generate the code signing certificate, and I paid them $500. So they are money printing machines. I'm sorry, I have no sympathy to the CAs. They are money printing machines. They are. And so for a code signing certificate, they need to verify your company. They need to validate that the information you put into the code signing certificate, like the company name, the website, blah, 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 is an actual company that's, you know, actually exists and those information are valid. And because basically you are signing the release, and the signing, you know, if they can't issue a code signing certificate for my company to a different company, that would be very bad because the company could impersonate me by signing something. So they have to validate the entity they are issuing the certificate to. The problem becomes that as a non-US company, which Netcore, the company behind Unimas, is called Netcore. Unimas is the product, company is called Netcore. So we are a non-US company, we are a Slovakian European company, and we applied for a code signing certificate. The problem becomes that all the processes they have for validating the company are breaching GDPR. So according to GDPR, which we have in Europe, you cannot publish PI, personally identifiable information, publicly online, which includes, you know, addresses, phone numbers, your social security numbers, your birth number, your, I don't know, insurance numbers. Basically, all those personally identifiable information cannot be publicly displayed online, which, if you think about it, that's good, right? There is no reason why all of my contact information, my address, my phone number, there is no reason this should be publicly available online for security or identity theft and security reasons.
So GDPR, right? Says a company can't publish that information, like if it's yours, they can't publish it, or that you
That information cannot, it doesn't matter if it's a company, you know, those information, even if I'm a founder of the company, I am an individual, and my PI information as an individual cannot be published online publicly in any way.
So it's not legal for you to put your own information up online?
So it's a little bit complicated, because if you put it yourself on your own blog, theoretically that should be okay because it's you. But no other company, like public people registries or even public phone number registries, are no longer allowed under GDPR. You are a company, you cannot collect basically and publish PI information. And by the way, since this has happened, like in the US you have a huge robocall problem. Mm-hmm. We don't really, it's much better here in Europe because we don't have public phone number registries. We don't, you know, GDPR went away with all of that. And also in Europe, when a robocaller calls you and you ask them, you know, how did you get my contact information? And basically you can threaten GDPR actions against robocallers, and robocallers pretty much don't exist in Europe. And that is thanks to GDPR, by the way. I like GDPR. It's a controversial topic. There are good things and bad things about GDPR, but in general, I think GDPR is a really good thing. Now, back to the CAs, right? So pretty much all of the company validation processes from the CAs are not compliant with GDPR, because they require, and I quote here, they require that every single founder of the company and the company information, including phone numbers and other things, should be, and I quote, published in a reputable local registry. Like, what does that mean? Reputable local registry. That basically means nothing. What is a reputable local registry? How do they validate if it is a local registry and if it's reputable? Basically, there is no specification on how they do it, first of all. Second of all, we cannot publish this online due to GDPR. Not even the official government Slovakian company registry has all the information they require to validate our company for a certificate. Why? Because it's an official government registry, but it still has to comply with GDPR. So there is no way for me to validate my company against the CA using any online tools, because I cannot, because I would breach GDPR. So the only way I can validate a European company with the CA is by getting a legally signed by a legal counsel or an attorney document that legally basically specifies that my information is correct, I am the owner of the company, and I can apply for the certificate. The problem here is that the CA, they send me these documents, and of course they are in English, but I am in Slovakia. Our lawyers, you know, they will not sign an English document because they don't understand it, first of all, well enough in the legalese English to be able to sign it, because it's in English, it's in their language. So what I have to do is, first, I have to get a state-approved translation. Basically, this is a state-certified translator that has to translate the document that was sent to me from the CA into Slovak. Then in here in Slovakia, I take it to a Slovakian attorney, which signs it and everything goes. But the problem is now that is in Slovakia. So in Slovakian. So now I have to go to a certified state translator again and have that same document translated back into English. So it has all the, you know, stamps and all the legal and government approved stuff on it. And now I need to send it back to the CA. This, all in all, costs about $3,000. And that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's not just about the cost. It's about the time. It's about finding all of those state, you know, approved certified translators, finding the attorney, then, you know, submitting all of the documents, waiting for the translation, putting it to the attorney, waiting for the signature, putting it back to the blah, 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 blah. It's ridiculous. It's stupid. And the entire fault, I am sorry, I have zero, like, it's the CA's fault because they haven't adjusted their processes to comply with GDPR. And if you think about it, how stupid it is from a certificate authority to ask that all of your personally identifiable information be publicly posted online. They might just as well tell me, get your identity stolen.
Hmm.
Like, that is stupid in 2019.
And I guess
to require that.
I guess anybody who had already been signed up with CAs probably got grandfathered in, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, yeah. Once you are verified and once you are approved and all of that, you just renew the certificate and there is nothing to it.
Yeah. So there's just a small number of people that are really pushing for this to happen, which is probably why it hasn't happened yet. Because I guess if everybody had to go through this process again, it would have been fixed almost instantaneously, right?
Well, it's not just that, you know, certificate authorities, really, code signing certificates are the vast minority of certificates. The vast majority of certificates will be your standard, you know, TLS encryption certificates for your Apache and GNX web servers. This is where they make their money. You know, so this has changed a little bit since Let's Encrypt, and Let's Encrypt is basically a free certificate authority. But back, if you go back to the days before Let's Encrypt, some of these certificate authorities like Komodo or Tafte, or there are many others, they were issuing up to 200 million certificates a year. This is why I'm saying they get access to money printing machines. If you think just $20 per certificate, and by the way, this is super cheap, like extended validation certificates are $2,000 for EV extended validation certificate. So if you think how much money they are making, it's in hundreds of millions. These are money printing machines with companies behind them that make super amount of money. And code signing certificates are harder because they have to validate the company, you know, which takes work, and the certificate is like $500, which is not that much. So they have to validate the company and blah 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 blah. So really, even because I went to LiveChat and asked their support, you know, do you have some GDPR, EU compliant documents or processes? And they said, we don't know what you are talking about. Publish your information in a trusted local registry. I said, I cannot. That breaches GDPR. Okay, write a support ticket. And they were literally assholes. They were like, we don't want to deal with you. You know, you are not easy money for us. Right. We don't want to deal with you.
Right.
So it's ridiculous. I have zero, zero respect or zero... I just don't like the CAs. It's a, you know, old dying breed business. Now with Let's Encrypt, they are a dying business. The problem is with code signing certificates, it's a little bit different. And, you know, making so much money, having access to money printing machines, to require stupid procedures like publishing all your PA information online and not adjusting to GDPR after it's been, you know, after it's been law for what, year and a half now, it's stupid. They should do better. They should do so much better.
The struggle is real, man.
Yeah. Anyway.
So that's that. All right, brother. We're about on an hour and a half, so I think we should probably save everything else for the next cast. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Let's end it on the rant.
That's what everybody comes for. You know, you can't give them that ahead of time. You got to save it for the end.
All right.
So, Thomas, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they go about that?
So that's very easy. If you want to find me, you will find me. Just Google my name. I am on social networks.
It's tricky with GDPR nowadays to find you.
No, the name is public and everything else. And of course, there is always unimus.net. Just I am always on there. We have live chat. If you want to reach me, just unimus.net is easiest.
Excellent. If you want to get a hold of me, I'm Greg at gregsoul.com. You just go to gregsoul.com. I very occasionally blog stuff there. Let's see what else. If you want to support us, if you somehow enjoy this, and not just for Thomas's rants, and you want to contribute to the cause, go to patreon.com/yourbrotherswisp. Jump in that Slack, man. I love, and most of the stuff I put in these things comes from the Slack. I'm too lazy to read the Facebook stuff anymore. I just pull all of my stuff out of the Slack, and I love the discourse in there. Probably the easiest way to get a hold of me outside of email is to just slide into my DMs on the Slack. I'm very responsive. I actually look at that far more frequently than I do my email nowadays. So I guess if you guys have any questions, comments, please come at me, bro. And we'll catch you guys next time.
We talk about equipment and methodology, so sit back and start learning. Lighting up the tower so people can start searching. Shooting up the web and neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, cause fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.